Good morning, Brandon 38. How the hell are you? Awesome. My name's Dan. I'm an addict. And I live in the pseudo-burgeoning metropolis of Gloucester, and my home group keeps 5 meetings going at a time each week. And about half of my home group members were here this weekend, which is awesome. Everybody salute for Gloucester, Virginia. Your enthusiasm is underwhelming, but it's okay. It's all right. I have known the speaker for 30 years. The idea of doing anything for 30 years is mind-boggling to me. But I actually had some time, relatively speaking. In the old days, we didn't know what we were doing. We were crazy people. We were absolutely batshit nuts. We were the blind leading the blind and foolish enough to try to follow through on it. We were a fellowship that was struggling to survive on our own 2 feet because we were dependent on training wheels provided to us by a different fellowship. And the story at that point in time is that you could not get clean and stay clean in Narcotics Anonymous because we depended on those training wheels. But there was a movement called the Purist Movement that came through, and we allowed ourselves to let go of the training wheels. And now the lie that you cannot recover in Narcotics Anonymous is dead. Thank God for the seventh tradition, which means more than the money we put in the basket. It means that we count on each other. We bet on each other. We bet on ourselves even when we are lousy bets, when no other bookie would count on us. Because there's a power greater than us that works through each and every one of us in unexpected ways that are not subject to somebody else's judgment. Last night, the speaker came up to me to go ahead and ask me to introduce him. And he had this silly look on his face, and I had this silly look on my face, and I'm sitting in a chair, and I'm giggling, and he's giggling, and I hold my arms open, and I tell him to come over here and sit on my lap, and he does. And I give him this smooshy face shit, but I didn't slip him any tongue, because I'm not that secure yet. And the funny thing about that was not what we were doing last night. The funny thing about that is the people we were when we came into this fellowship. We were desperately scared and afraid, hiding behind everything in the world that looked badass enough to keep you from knowing about our insecurities. We were homophobic, misogynistic, losers, victims of our own trauma, and believing in our own bullshit interpretation of what that trauma meant. And we're terrified that you were going to get to know who it was that we were, because we didn't know what to do about that. That's the fellowship that I walked into 35 years ago, and it's the fellowship that the speaker walked into 30 years ago. It is common parlance in recovery that hurt people hurt people. Then, we used to say, oh, well, you're not supposed to judge a book by the cover. But nobody wanted to pick up the book that looked like it might bite you. And the speaker looked like he might bite you. He was known to do things that I promised I wouldn't tell because he says that he's going to go ahead and tell them. The speaker is the only person I know that actually took up people on that adage that you could use a doorknob as a higher power. I like the symbolism about that, right? You can turn a doorknob to gain admission to a different way of living. But this fucker actually had a doorknob in his leather jacket pocket and would pray to it, daring you to tell him he was wrong. He's got an entirely different higher power now, although that higher power loved him just as much then as that higher power does now. That higher power doesn't care what name he called him then. He's okay with him calling him now as long as he calls him often. Ladies and gentlemen, this boys and girls, perpetrators, enablers, this gentleman used to be known solely as Psycho. Some people still know him that. But his real name, and my pleasure to introduce this gentleman, all right, my pleasure to introduce this man. I'm looking forward to hearing what Francis B. has to share with you today. Good morning, Brianna.
Good morning.
My name is Francis B., and I'm an ass.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And Dan's an asshole.
Yes, sir.
Tell us something we didn't know.
My clean date is October 8th, 1989. I didn't come in here because I wanted to. The drugs are doing for me exactly what they were supposed to be doing when I was taking them. You know, they were getting me high, wasting me out, clouding my judgment, which I didn't know that that's what they were doing, but that's what they do. I mean, I've never been an addict who says the drugs didn't do for me what they were supposed to do when I got here, because they did. I took drugs because I thought it was fun. I took drugs because it made me fit in. I did whatever the people around me did because I wanted to be a part of who they were. That being said, when I had 8 months clean, again, being forced to go to meetings, pee in a bottle, answer to a parole officer with the threat of 25 years of prison facing me, I was at this meeting, and I never introduced myself any time, but one time that I did, I raised my hand, and I said, "My name is Psycho, and I'm an addict." And a guy behind me said, you know, because in meetings we go, "Hello, so-and-so, love you lots," because I'm from the Love You Lots area in Tidewater. Yeah. I recently moved to Richmond. That girl that shared last night really lit me up on that, because I could relate to what she was talking about when it comes to changing locations. But this guy called me Francis because he knew my real name, because he worked with me. And I threw a folding chair at him and ran out of the room. Four or five addicts that I didn't know, because I wasn't in here to make friends. I didn't like any of you people. You didn't understand what I'd been through. You'd never know me, because I wasn't going to let you know me. Okay? They followed me outside and said, "It's okay, man. Come back next week." I've never experienced, anytime I got violent, the people called the cops and didn't want me back. You know, I I'm from Tidewater, and some of the old drinkers and users down there remember a place called, it just escaped me. It's in Ocean View. It used to be right in the middle. Became a Hardee's. Jolly Roger. That was it. The Jolly Roger. I got barred from that place. They put my picture on the wall. And this was a place that you could do just about anything. You know, they said, "We don't want that motherfucker back here." Excuse my language. If you're offended by my language, I'm sorry. I do it all the time, and, you know, because then what I started learning about 94 or 95, that was, you know, I'd been staying clean, but I hadn't been working steps. I was miserable all the time. I had this guy named Stu that I used to talk to all the time. He's a guru to some of the people that know him now, and he's deceased, and he died in his program clean. But back then, I would complain to him about being miserable. And he would say to me, "You know, there's a difference between clean time and recovery time." And I believe that today. That doesn't mean that I don't relapse. Because, see, he also taught me that relapse isn't picking up the drug. The relapse is the result. The drug picking up is a result of your relapse. You know, because you slip back into your old way of thinking. You slip back into your old behaviors. And I was still there. I hadn't even gotten out of that yet. I was still judging people. I would sit in meetings and look across the room, because I would still sit with my back to the wall. I did not trust anyone. I didn't know how to trust anyone. You know, trust was a real big issue with me. If you weren't from my world, I couldn't talk to you. If you didn't hang with the people I hung with, I couldn't hang with you. So, see, I'm old. Dan knows, because 30 years ago, they said this to you:
Work the steps to die, motherfucker. And they meant it. They weren't going to bullshit with you. If you wanted to stay clean and grow up, then they would help you. But if you didn't, they would look at you and say, here's 20 bucks, go buy a joint. Go buy your dope and finish it out. Because they didn't, it wasn't this, I've said this before, it wasn't the we don't want to hurt your feelings kind of program. You know? But they also would come knocking on my door. We didn't have cell phones. So in 1992, a guy named Joe B. had left a message on my answering machine. Some of my friends have heard this story, so I'm going to tell it to the people that don't know it. I came home one Saturday afternoon against, you know, all nothing to do. I couldn't go hang out with my buddies and get high, so I went home. And my red light was flashing on my answering machine. And on the answering machine was a message asking me to drive to the Eastern Shore, pick up a broken down motorcycle, put it on my truck, and bring him home. He would pay for all my gas. That was the guy I threw the chair at, by the way. Okay? But I'd gotten to know him, and we became friends along the way. And he had been trying to con me into going to East Coast Convention of Narcotics Anonymous. In 1992, and all I could vision a convention at. See, Brana's great. I love Brana. I love everything like this, because when I got here, my vision was five addicts in a hotel room fighting over who's going to make the next pot of coffee. That's a convention. You know? And what I discovered was, because when I got there, we loaded his bike up, and he begged and hemmed and hawed, come on, man, I was halfway there. I'll pay for all your gas. So we went to Ocean City, and I had a great time. I watched 5,000 addicts raise their hand in the room on Countdown. I was amazed at the love and the understanding from people that didn't even know me. They didn't know me, and they still wanted to help me. That whole weekend, Sunday morning, we left the hotel room that he had rented, and we went and had breakfast. And I was talking with these guys after breakfast outside the hotel room. And when I come around the corner to my truck, he's rolling his bike down off my truck. He rode his fucking motorcycle home that weekend. And I wasn't even mad, because I had had so much fun. Then the growing had to start. I spent time chasing women in this program without, you know, thinking the things outside of me would fix me. Dan remembers when I had 7 motorcycles, because that was the new deal. You know, I had antique cars, but I owed money to everybody because I still wasn't working steps. You know, I was living on this, if I have this, it'll be great. And as soon as I get it, the emptiness was gone again. I have a higher power today whom I choose to call God. When I got here, I had a belief in that God. I believed he was a butthead, never cared about me, never did anything for me, and was never going to do anything for me. That I was condemned for life because I could never measure up to what I thought the God of my understanding at that time would want from me. And Stu, at that time, was my sponsor, and I went to live with him because he made me understand I had to get rid of all the shit I had. And Chucky, my buddy, will tell you, this guy used to break out a book and throw it on the table and do step work for dinner. You know? He worked steps out of his house. But he shoved this stuff down your throat. Because again, I'm from the school where they didn't wait for you to want it. We didn't believe that we could wait for you to want it because you just die. And I still don't believe that. I don't believe that my job is to wait for an addict to walk into the rooms and raise his hand. My job is to see the addict on the street and drag him to a meeting. You know, my job is to do whatever it takes. Some people call that promoting the program. Well, yeah, maybe it is. But that's what a 12-step really is. A 12-step isn't waiting for them to come and ask me to help them work the steps. The 12-step is when I make them understand that they need to work the steps. They need to stay in this program. Because when I got here, I didn't think that. If I had been left to my own devices when I got here, then I would still be out there using. Because I wasn't going to call people back. I wasn't going to hang out with drug addicts that were in recovery. They didn't have anything to offer me. But they would come to my house and say, first they'd call, I'd answer the phone, can we go to a meeting? No. 5 minutes later, want to go to a meeting? No. Well, get in the car because you're going anyway. You know? And they wouldn't take no for an answer. And that's the way it was. And sometimes I get into arguments with people because they forget that that's how we got here. The people that, you know, I'm one of those people that, yeah, when I had 13 years clean, I stepped away from the program because now I got a connection with the God of my understanding, right? And you know what happened? My life went right downhill again. I wasn't using, but all them behaviors and attitudes and thinking were coming back. You know, I was starting to hang out with some of my old buddies. I was chasing down old ideas. And then I ran into an addict who would come in here and I used to sponsor this kid when I had like 12 years clean. I used to throw a book at him and tell him, work the steps to die, motherfucker. You know, we didn't have the golden and green book to teach you how to work steps. We did it out of the basic text. We would read the step, you know. So I would do that with him. Well, I ran into him in a shopping center in Virginia Beach one day at Lynn Haven Mall. And he said, man, where the hell you been? I said, well, I go to church now. I got all this shit going on. You know, he's like, you need to come back to the rooms, man. They need you in there. And he was right. I went back. And of course, I had been talking to him about what had been going on in my life. And he said, you might need to be in there, too. You know, and he was right, you know. And that boy's name was Keith at the time. We know him as Shannon now, those that just met him. But his name was Keith. And he's one of my dear friends today. But he got me to come back to the rooms. And you know what I found? I found that he was correct. A lot of us people who get it, we go away and forget to bring it back. We forget that. You know, what I heard from the God of my understanding then was, go back to where you found me. Go back to where you found me and take it. And so that's what I do, you know. And I've had people complain because I talk about God too much in the program. You know, I tell them today, call your sponsor. Because the word God is in the basic text a lot. And it, you know, a higher power is for your insecurity to get you. Yeah, I carried a doorknob, Dan, because back then I didn't trust that God that I grew up with. Because I had my vision of it, you know. But then Stu said to me one day, he said, so who makes up your rules now? I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, who's the God of your understanding? I said, well, you know, he's just a guy who loves me, cares about me. He said, no. This is what he told me. My addiction talks to me in my own voice. When God talks to me in my own voice, that's my addiction. God talks to me through the people in the rooms, through the people I seek to teach me about him. So go to the rooms and ask how, when you hear somebody sharing about God, ask them how they came to that understanding. And they'll show you. They'll tell you. And if it works for you, that was the other thing that Dan and people like him taught me. I didn't have to do anything I didn't want to do. You don't have to. You what is it we say? You can keep your misery for as long as you want? Yeah. You can, and it'll gratefully be refunded when you walk out the door. But you can stay unhappy as long as you choose to stay unhappy. No one's going to make you do anything. And they're still going to be there. They're still going to pick you up. They're still going to care for you. They're still going to like you. They're going to love on you. You know, I heard this, we'll love you till you can love yourself. I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know that you needed to love yourself. Nobody told me that when I was growing up. You know what I heard when I was growing up? Shut your mouth. Here, I heard, if we want to know how to use, we'll talk to you. Otherwise, sit there, put the cotton in your mouth, out of your ears, and put it in your mouth, and learn something. But then the meetings became a classroom for me where I could live the other 23 days of my life, 23 hours of the day, you know. One day at a time. I told a guy outside here before, when I first got down here this morning, I had 3 days. Where you at? Are you in here? There you are. Keep coming back, man. Because the only difference between him and me, is that I kept putting one day together all the time. But I told him, I said, I still deal with issues. I still get resentful. I still get hateful. I still get unhappy. I still get worried. I still deal with stress. None of that. Life showed up when I stopped using drugs. You know? Narcotics Anonymous showed me how to live when I was only existing. They showed me what it meant to live. See, I was getting up every morning, going to work, getting drugs, going home, going to work, getting up, getting drugs. And it was a revolving door. Today, I deal with stuff I've never dealt with before. I have friends that I can call, though, and I can talk to them. And then I meet new people, you know? The guys, where's your spitballs? I met David today, and Jeff, apparently, he knew me a long time, or knew of me, and we knew some of the same people in recovery, but I came to Brandon and saw and met them this year, you know? Because that's what this program has taught me, that anybody can, and I hang out with women today without trying to, like, get something from them. I have plenty of female friends who just are my friends. I learned that in this program. I learned that I could have friends of all genders. I learned that your sexual preference is none of my business, and I don't have to judge you for it. You know, when I had 11 years, I think, I can't remember his name now. He was in my home group, and I went to him for information all the time, and he was gay, and I never knew it because I hadn't been judging him based on his lifestyle. I've been listening to him share, you know. And he taught me some things. And then somebody said to me one day, why do you hang out with him? He's gay. I said, he is. Could have fooled me. Oh, well. Because he became a friend. He became somebody I trusted. His sexual preference was none of my business. I've been real nervous about standing up here. So I'm real grateful that only about 50 of you showed up. Because this is like talking to a home group. And I do that a lot. And people say, man, we love to hear your story. Because I believe in the program of Narcotics Anonymous, but like Dan said, I know where it came from. It came from AA, and I'm not afraid to tell people. When I got here, there weren't enough meetings in Narcotics Anonymous to go to an AA meeting every day. There just weren't. It was a small organ. AA was where I had to go to. That's where Stu was. That's one of my early sponsors was an AA person. But because of that, I learned things. Like, I love the fact that I had to understand that alcohol was a drug. Because I probably would have thought, well, if I get control of the cocaine and the meth, I'll be all right with drinking. But these people in the AA meetings taught me that alcohol could be a problem, too. And then I go to Narcotics Anonymous, and they say, no, you can't be clean. Now, one of the problems we did make in early recovery was we used to judge people on their medical pills and say, oh, well, if you're taking that, you're not really clean. Bullshit. If a doctor prescribes something to you, take it. You know? Again, if whatever it takes for you not to go to mind-altering, mood-changing substances that make you the psycho motherfucker that you can be, because I can still be that. Some of my friends know it. You know, he's alive and well up here. You know? Character defects never go away. I don't believe that. I don't believe character defects go away. I don't believe God removes them. What I learned to understand from this addict is that God makes me aware of those character defects so that when they resurface, I see them and I can stop them because they're the relapse that's going to kill me. See, it's not the drug that's going to kill me, get me killed. It's the relapse that's going to get me killed. The drug will kill me. But the relapse is going to take me there. And my addiction that talks to me in my own voice wants me to believe I don't have a disease. You know? Wants me to believe that God is not the answer. God is the answer. Like it or not, people, God is the answer. How you come to that understanding of that God is your business. But I will freely stand here and tell you that God is the answer. Because this is a spiritual, not religious program. And that's what I learned in here, was that religion is what made me afraid of the God that I understand today. Spirituality is my relationship with Him. See, and I have a relationship with a God who is very spiritual, who cares about me, and in my belief, will punish me when I fuck up. You know, that's my belief though. You know? But I only stay punished as long as I stay in the fuck up. Because as soon as I get out of it and I start doing the right thing, the God of my understanding forgives me and moves me on down the road. See, recovery is not knowing and not being aware, recovery is continually not doing what you're already aware of. Recovery is learning to put back what should have been put there in the first place. You know, I wish I had come from one of the, but I know people in this program that came from those perfect houses with perfect parents, you know, and that didn't work either, you know. And that's the great thing about Narcotics Anonymous. They taught us, and they still teach us, that there's nothing we can do wrong here except use. That's all we can do wrong. Everything else is a process. It's a simple spiritual. I love the theme this year. Last year's was good too, though, giving it away. Because I believe that that's how I got what I have today. Because people kept giving it to me. They kept calling me. They kept dragging me to meetings. They kept involving me in events. They kept me going when I wanted to quit. They kept giving it to me. But simplicity is the key. If I get out of the way and I just do the simple shit, I'll be fine. It's when I get in the way and I want to complicate it and I want to say, but what if and how about and this and that. That girl last night said it best. The way I know I'm in God's will is when I don't have to manipulate it or control it or make it happen. It just happens. When I moved to Richmond, I've been wanting to move to Richmond for a good 2 or 3 years because I'm a vet and I'm under the care of the VA hospital. And I wanted to be at the one in Richmond because it's way better than the one in Hampton. And I used to drive up here just to get the care from them. And I have this friend that lives in Richmond. And again, I live on a fixed income. I'm retired, disability, and I don't have a whole lot of money. So I said to him when I was at his house one day, I said, man, if you ever decide you don't want to live here anymore, let me know. I'd love to live in this house. And about November, no, because we moved in October. We moved in November. So September of last year, he calls me up on the phone. He says, my wife and I are thinking about buying a new house. I said, well, I can't afford to buy your house, man. He said, no, I'll just let you live in it. You pay my mortgage. You know, his mortgage is $700 a month. You know, and then he let me bring stuff up and start storing it in his garage. You know, that was a sign to me that I was meant to move to Richmond. But years before that, when I had a heart attack and I had the pacemaker put in and I couldn't go to work anymore, I mean, my wife can tell you, we were packing stuff up and putting it in a neighbor's garage because we weren't going to be able to afford the rent for the house we were living in, so we knew we were going to have to move. And I told the landlord, look, I'm going to have to move, blah, blah, blah. And then I filed for Social Security disability. And you want to know how fast God works? 90 days I started getting my check. I mean, in 90 days they paid me. I couldn't believe that because I had friends who had been fighting for years for Social Security disability and couldn't get it. And I got it quick. And then my landlord came down the street and said, oh, you can stay here till y'all get on your feet. We're not going to charge. He's not in the program. That guy wasn't in the program. But he understood that I was. I lived in his house for 7 years. You know? And this was 10 years ago, so I had 20 years clean. And I was working a program, and I was helping people. In fact, when I found out I was going to collect Social Security, I was doing a 12-step with a guy I was letting live in my house who was ADHD and alcoholic and really fucked up in the head. And I was taking him to this church I knew to help blow the lady out who could no longer live where she was living, and the church was helping get her a place. And I came home and my wife said, what's this? And I opened it up and it was a check from Social Security. It was a Statue of Liberty or whatever they put on there. And I called my lawyer up. I said, can I cash this thing? And he said, yeah. And I said, how much do I have to pay you? He said, I'm already paid. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. How does this work? It works because I got out of the way. I was scared to death. How was I going to survive back then before that check came in? How am I going to survive? You know? But I kept praying. And I kept believing. And I kept going to meetings. And I kept talking to people. And people who could help me, help me. People that couldn't help me, couldn't help me. Because, see, not everybody has my solution. Not everybody has the aid I need. But if I don't go into the rooms and if I don't talk to my network and tell them, then they don't know I need it. And that's the thing that Dan and people like that taught me. Stu and Joe and Chucky. These people taught me valuable things that were absolutely simple. Just ask for help. You can't do it all by yourself. That's why this is a we program. You know, the difference between AA and NA is one great thing. It does say we before each step to make it clear that we do this together. I could never have envisioned 30 years ago that I'd have the understanding and the belief and the faith in the God that I grew up with, because I'm a product of Catholic school, you know. I tell people I'm a recovering Catholic, you know. But that's the way I was raised. That was my parents' solution. Put him in a reform school that's run by Christian brothers. They'll fix him. No, they didn't. They made it worse. Because they tried to show me something I couldn't understand. They tried to complicate it. If they'd have been drug addicts who said, look, man, all you got to do is ask for help and go to meetings and talk about your problems and write about your issues, you know, and have faith. See, faith is believing in something that you cannot see, you know. I could walk into a room. I've been to California, walked into meetings in California and felt like I was right at home. You know, but yet when I moved to Richmond, that girl last night, she made so much sense. Because when I moved to Richmond, oh man, I was like, these people aren't going to know me. They didn't grow up with me in this program. They didn't watch the addict that walked in the rooms. And then my friends keep telling me, just raise your hand. Tell them you're new. I thought it would be so simple to move to a new area and do that. And you know what? It was one of the hardest things I did. But I did it. I finally did it. Now I have a home group, which is Living Clean on Sunday night in Midlothian. And I have friends up there, and I'm still making friends up there, and I'm getting contacts, and I'm outreaching again, because that's what I need to do. I can't sit at home and recover. I can sit at home and stay clean, but I'm going to be miserable. Like Stu said, if you're not recovering, all you are is clean, and all clean is miserable. Clean time is miserable unless it's recovery. Because recovery means I'm doing something. I'm active. I'm seeking a solution. You know? When I have a problem there, I want to know, how can I do this? Because I don't know. Most of what I deal with, I haven't got a clue. You know? I made a remark to Dan. There was a time when I came in this program, I was a biker. I rode with a group of club, and that's what identified me. And then I found a clean and sober club, and that's what identified me. And now I'm at this point in my life where I'm trying to, like, wean that. I took my patch off before I came up here and hung it, gave it to my wife. Because it's not that I don't enjoy it, and there's nothing wrong with it, but I need to get to a point in my life where that patch is not my identity, you know, because I don't need it. I am who I am. I can still be psycho. That's cool. Because I went to this group that I rode with for 18 years in recovery. And I asked their president, I said, can I change my name now? Because I've got like 20 years clean and I'm not psychotic anymore and I don't do stupid shit. And he said, no, you still have to keep that name because you're psycho in the other direction. And it's true. My friends that know me know that I am psycho in the recovery side instead. I don't do, you know, I don't do wheelies on my motorcycle, and I don't run in the opposite direction at 120 miles an hour. I got a friend that did that, a newcomer in the program, who I love dearly, but I know he's going to grow through that. I don't do that, but I've done that stupid shit. I've done that stupid shit. I know today that if I get on the interstate and do 100 miles an hour with my motorcycle, the cop stops me, gives me a ticket, it's not his fault. You know, it's my fault. I can make that choice. That doesn't mean I'll do it, but it's no longer, like girl said it last night, the world is not out to get me. I'm out to get the world when I'm acting like that. I'm fighting the world. The world's not against me, I'm against the world. You know, and I don't have to be who I am. Doesn't mean I have to conform to everything, but I don't have to be. This program taught me I don't have to influence people. I don't have to impose on people. I don't have to force my will on people. That's amazing, you know, because that's what I was doing when I got here, and I didn't know that. I thought I was. Stu said to me one time, he said, let's say that you're right, that you have the right to play your music and have live bands in your backyard at 2 o'clock in the morning. Let's say you have that right. What about your neighbor's right to quiet? What about that? You know, I had to come in this program and learn, and I learned it, that people have rights that are conflicting with what I think are my rights, but they still have rights and I have to respect them and I have to give to them. That's that responsible, productive member of society. You know, when I become a member of society, that means I give and I take. That means I respect as well as get respected. When I moved out of Ocean View with 14 years clean, my neighbors, and I rode with a patch on my back, and there were always motorcycles in front of my house, and my neighbors came to me and said, "Do you got to move?" I'm like, "Yeah, well, I got to move. I'm going." They're like, "But there's so much quiet here. There's no crime on this street." I guess because all them people in Ocean View saw them bikers, they thought, "We better not go down that street." We were all clean and sober bikers. But nobody but my neighbors knew it, but they didn't want me to leave. I couldn't believe it. Every other neighborhood I ever lived in when I was with the other boys, they're like, "Good lad, see them motherfuckers go." You know, I love Narcotics Anonymous. It is by far the only way that this drug addict could have gotten a life and learned how to live rather than exist. You know? And I have so much gratitude that, you know, Saturday I went up on the rocks and my younger brother was here 10 years before me. He was 24 years old when he decided to quit drinking and got clean. And in 1997 he talked me into coming to this, and I have been coming ever since. And he died a year ago in June 3rd. And this is a guy that when we were growing up, we were mortal enemies. We kicked and beat each other on a regular basis. There was a bet when we got together on who would go to the hospital and who would go to jail. But when we got into this program, he became my best friend. I spent 5 years in New York getting to know him, living with him. And then he died, and I went up there Saturday and dumped his ashes. And it was just a little urn, so they don't get no ecology bone. You know, just a little tiny urn, people. I didn't dump the whole basket. But I miss him today. And I can remember when I used to hate his guts because we were so different, but we were so alike. And the reality is, the things I learned from him are this: I can dislike you, but I don't have to hate you. I can love you, but I don't have to hang out with you. I can care about what happens to you, but I don't have to deal with it. I can do what I can do to help you, and if I can't help you, I can at least listen to you. You know, because sometimes that's a big help and people don't realize. That's what you get when you come in here and you raise your hand and you say, "I'm an addict named Francis. Thanks for letting me share."